So, thank you all for coming. Keith and Doug. I thought I might speak tonight about how those of us who are born or to live in the Western world can understand something which is in some ways different from Western culture, and that is the deities. Oh, yes, the better to see you, my dear. So, I taught a course on the history of Indian religion at the University of Florida in Gainesville. And in that course, I explained that the iconoclasm of not only the West, but also the Middle East, the opposition to or hostility to toward worship of a visible deity is actually related to the environmental problems we face on Earth. And so I hope I got your attention with that. So I'm going to explain. First of all, here we have three deities, Lord Jagannath, Lady Subhadra, Lord Balaram. And clearly, in one sense, these forms have been constructed out of material elements. In fact, these deities were originally worshipped in a city on the eastern coast of India, Puri, or Jagannath Puri, and every so many years they have a ceremony called Navakalevaram, which means new body, in which the old form of the deity made of hardwood is, I think, cast into the ocean, and they put a new form. So even though we say this is a spiritual form or a spiritualized form in the real world, it has been constructed from the material element. So basically the argument I will make here, my mother always said I would be a good lawyer. So the argument I want to make here is that it is especially in pre-philosophical cultures that something like deity worship becomes a major problem. First of all, both in a spiritual culture like Krishna consciousness, but also in terms of ordinary science and philosophy, we can say that a higher understanding, whether it is spiritual or religious or philosophical or empirical, a higher understanding begins when one does not accept the information that we receive from our material senses as a complete report, as complete information about the world we live in. For example, if we ask the simple question, which science, philosophy, and theology all ask, what is matter? You sit down there. What is matter? So if you trust your senses, if you simply trust your senses, you could say, for example, this microphone is metal and plastic, the floor is made of God knows what nowadays. And so on. But of course, this answer that, okay, what is matter? That is just a floor made of, you know, whatever. This is a microphone. No, a scientist wants to know, what is matter? what is matter actually? And so we get into the area of chemistry and physics, and then we begin to explore matter, and ultimately physicists, somewhat pretentiously, believe that they have understood what matter really is. It's actually, like they say, you know, if you imagine a huge soccer field and something like, you know, like a little, I don't know, some very tiny little, like a grain of sand on a soccer field, and then another grain of sand at the other side, that's something like the space between the subatomic particles and so on, in terms of ratio, proportion. So science comes to a very different conclusion about what matter is. They come to a very different conclusion than that information given by our senses. Let's say a person under normal viewing conditions, operating with let's say reasonably well-functioning senses under normal viewing conditions, and you get a certain picture of matter, that is not at all the picture science accepts. They want to go to what they would consider to be a deeper, more profound understanding, also philosophy. Philosophy can ask the question, what is matter? For example, let's say I look at the yellow wall, and then philosophy may ask the question, or nowadays, in this field, philosophy and neurology are kind of coming together. But we can ask the simple question, where's the color? Wo ist die Farbe? Is it, for example, in my eyes? Is it in my brain? Is it in the wall? Is it somewhere between my eye and the wall? Where is the color? And so on. And then spiritually we can ask, in terms of theology, or in our case, Krishna consciousness, our product, we could raise the question, all right, given all the information we receive from matter, from science, given all the available scientific information, and given all the available philosophical analysis of matter, what do we have to say about it? What do we have to say about matter? Now, it's interesting that both in science, empirical science, and in theology or spiritual philosophy, there are competing theories, or not necessarily competing, but there are somewhat different theories about origins. In other words, where does matter come from? Practically in all fields of knowledge, there is the idea that knowing the history of something is an important part of understanding that thing. For example, if you're trying to understand your own psychology and why you are the way you are, and why you're sometimes angry when there's no good reason to be angry, why you're sometimes depressed or unhappy, or why you sometimes become attached to people who are total losers. You know, these are the kinds of questions people ask themselves. And so normally when someone wants to psychologically investigate themselves or with professional help, you have to know the history of the person. What is the history of the person? Or what is your own history? What kind of family were you born in? What kind of parents did you have? What culture did you live in? What happened in your life? Did you experience traumas as you were growing up? And so on and so forth. And also, what is your neurological condition? Are there any special neurological conditions? And so, in that way, we explore the history of we explore history to try to understand the present. Or another example, the history of Germany. In order to understand what Germany is today, in terms of what you might call the collective understanding, the national consciousness, Germany's, for example, why does Germany have certain foreign policies in international affairs? Why does Germany have certain economic policies? Why does Germany have certain kinds of relationships with its neighbors? Why does Germany have certain kinds of immigration policies? Why did a certain kind of art or a certain kind of music become prominent in Germany, let's say, in the last 20 years? And so on and so forth. So if you wanted to understand Germany today, obviously you have to know something about the history. Or to understand any country. This is true for any country, to understand the history. For example, let's see you see a man and woman on the street and they're arguing or they're embracing. What's the history? Or, for example, let's say you work for an insurance company. And there is what they call in America a fender bender, which means an accident that's not very serious. You know, in the road they call it a fender bender. So then you come out as the insurance adjuster, and you know, you're not supposed to move the car. Why? Why? Because in order to understand the accident, who was responsible for the accident, you have to actually reverse what is called the time arrow. Events proceed through time in a certain way. You could say that events proceed from the present toward the future. So if you just imagine like a physical direction. But then when you try to understand the cause of something, you actually have to go in the other direction. In actual time, a cause precedes an effect. But in terms of investigation, analysis, whether it's biology, history, geology, microbe, anything, you actually go backwards. You start with the effect, and you proceed back toward the cause. So, this was a logical principle developed thousands of years ago in India. So the idea is that the cause is still present in the effect. In other words, if you look at this, at the situation after a traffic accident, and you see the skid marks on the road, you know, the marks of the tires, you see how the cars were damaged, the position of the cars, you study everything about the physical situation, and then you analyze what actually caused this. What kind of cause, what would have caused these two cars to be in the positions they are now? Or, for example, let's say in microbiology, there's a disease, a common disease, so you look at a healthy body, you look at a diseased body, and then you try to trace. You go backwards. What could have happened in a healthy body to produce a diseased body? So the simple point I'm trying to make is that we have to understand the history of things in order to deeply understand them. And so you find both in science, for example, in theoretical physics or cosmogony or astronomy, as well as in spiritual teachings, you find a serious interest in trying to understand what is the ultimate cause of everything. So, what is the cause of matter? What is matter ultimately? That was the point I was getting at. If we want to understand what matter is, because the deities are made of matter, you see, I still remember the topic. Not that old. So, I can still remember what I said 15 minutes ago. So, sometimes. So, since the deity is made of matter, what is the history of matter? And another question, here's an example of a philosophical question. Is it possible to understand the history of matter in purely material terms? For example, to explain what this means, let's say you want to understand the history of Germany. Or let's say you want to understand the history of, I don't know, Australia. Everyone likes Australia because they're so far away they never bother and they smile a lot. So, Australians. Actually, that's not a good example because they're too far away. Let's say you want to understand the history of Mexico. I'm from California, so if you want to understand the history of Mexico, you cannot simply study the history of Mexico. You have to understand the history of the United States. You must understand the history of Spain. You have to understand the history of Central America. You even have to understand the history of the Habsburg Empire. So there are many things you have to understand. You cannot study only Mexico and understand Mexico. In the same way, for example, if you study a body, and a body has certain problems, you cannot understand the body simply by studying the body. You have to study the bodies of other people genetically related to that person. You have to understand the environment because certain diseases are environmentally caused. So In other words, to understand something, you have to understand also its context. Its context. So, therefore, it is actually a reasonable question. Can we understand matter simply by understanding matter? Or wouldn't it be necessary, as with everything else in the world, to understand the context of matter? And so by definition, the context is something beyond matter. For example, if we say to understand German history, you have to understand other factors beyond Germany, it means things which are not Germany. So you have to understand the context by definition must not be matter, because if it was matter, it wouldn't be the context. It would just be studying the one thing itself. Now, moving right along here. If this is too much philosophy, you can't stand it anymore, then we'll feed you outside. So there's another point, and that is we have very solid evidence that actually matter does have a context, which is not material. We have we have evidence if we simply look at the German government. You didn't know that your leaders were so spiritual. Anyway, but this is the point I want to make. Germany obviously is a democracy. I mean, all democracies are kind of, theoretically, it's a democracy. I mean, we all know, especially in America, we all know how democracies are becoming actually plutocracies, which means ruled by the rich. But that's another question. But at least officially it's a democracy, and you still have lots of democratic rights. And Germany, by far, is not the most corrupt country in the world. So, what is the justification for democracy? Why have democracy? The justification, obviously, is that because we're equal. Isn't it? Wir sind egal. So, the issue is, here's a simple question. How can you base a government on an assumption or a belief which, according to all empirical science, is nonsense? All empirical science, not some of it, not 70% of it, not 93% of it, all empirical science tells us that we are not equal. We are not equal intellectually, athletically, artistically, financially, socially, you name it. We are not equal, empirically. Now, Aristotle, one of the earliest members of the Hare Krishna movement, another case of a Gyatra Sukriti, he didn't know he's in the Hare Krishna movement. But anyway, Aristotle said, as Descartes said later, the French philosopher Descartes, that really there are two basic dimensions of the world we live in, which are the physical and, as Aristotle put it in Greek, the metaphysical. Meta means beyond, the metaphysical. So, obviously, since we are not empirically equal, in other words, we are not physically equal, the only other possibility is that we are metaphysically equal. So, what does that mean to be metaphysically equal? For example, a value like justice. If I say, a flower garland, we are, the Hare Krishna movement, we do lots of flower garlands. So, this is a physical object. You can touch it, you can smell it, you can throw it up in the air, and so on. It's a physical object, but justice is not a physical object. You cannot point to a real thing and say, this is justice. Let's say, for example, an example of justice. Let's say that there's a situation where someone, because of his race, because of his ethnicity, nationality, religion, political views, whatever, is denied access to some public service. And then the government steps in and they correct that and the person does receive equal access to whatever public service. That's an example of justice. But you can't point to it. You say, well, look, Now we have a situation in Germany where people from all these different backgrounds have the same access to public services, but that's just an empirical event. You just see a bunch of people, different colors, different backgrounds, different ethnic or political or cultural or national backgrounds, let's say going to some government office and getting the same service. But why call it justice? Or why say it's a value? If you say by the word justice, I mean that when people from different backgrounds get the same service, sure, you can define the word that way, and then you can say this is an example of what I call justice. So you can do that. But if you want to take the further step and say we should have justice, we should have justice, then you have completely abandoned the realm of empirical science and physical reality, and you are floating in a very metaphysical space. In fact, any German word or any German sentence, well, I say English, I like any English sentence that has the word should, I guess in German sollen, right? Sie sollen, sie sollten, and so on. Any English word with the auxiliary verb should, or any German sentence with the word sollen, is a metaphysical sentence. It's the difference between sein and sollen. Sein is in the physical world. Sollen is in the metaphysical world. Is and should. Because after all, if someone says the government should provide justice, someone could say, warum? You know, why? Why? And at that point, no empirical answer will answer the question. The philosopher, actually, I think he was Scottish, the philosopher David Hume pointed this out. Kant, you know, he's German, actually. Er war Deutsch. The philosopher Kant, he made a very famous statement, Kant. He said that before Hume, we were all sleeping. Before Hume, we were all sleeping, the philosophers. And Hume woke us up because he was so obnoxious. And he also made some good arguments. He wasn't merely obnoxious, he also made some good arguments. For example, let's take an example of justice and injustice. Injustice, someone goes and kills an innocent person. And we say that is bad, that is evil, that is immoral. And then an example of something good. Let's say someone goes to someone who's suffering and helps that person without any selfish motivation. They help a person that's suffering. We say that is good, that is moral. What Hume pointed out is that if you study a physical act, for example, the physical act of killing an innocent person or the physical act of helping a suffering person with no selfish motive, you cannot find in the physical description of those acts goodness or evil. There is no empirical object you will discover, like you examine someone's body and you find oxygen or you find, you know, iron or this or that. There's no empirical object called justice or injustice, good or evil, that you can find in any material object. And therefore, all of our values, such as equality, well, I was just in France, liberté, égalité, and fraternité. All these values are metaphysical. So what that means is you have two choices. Either you believe the empirical story, the empirical creation myth, which is that actually there is nothing but matter, there are no souls, there's no God, there's only dead matter, which becomes conscious at a certain point neurologically. And if this is true, then there's no such thing as justice. Justice is not a real thing. Injustice is not a real thing. The real story here is that blind nature, the blind forces of evolution have programmed us neurologically to believe an illusion that some actions are actually good and some actions are actually bad. That's obviously not true because nothing exists but matter. And therefore, if someone kills a child, that's not really bad. We are just, evolution has programmed us neurologically to believe that's bad. Now, I don't think any of us really accept that story. I don't think any civilized human being accepts that story. And because we reject that story, not just because the consequences are so horrible, but we reject that story because we know within the deepest part of ourselves that some things are really bad and some things are really good. It's something we know. For example, anyway, I won't get into technical epistemology here, but I'll just make the simple point. I'll make this simple point. All of empirical science begins with an unproved and unprovable assumption. This is Jagannath's own restaurant. All empirical science begins with an unproved and unprovable assumption, and that is that there is a material world that actually exists outside of our minds. I mean, we've all heard that story. Maybe there's an evil genius somewhere, and we are just little brains in laboratories. And we are, you know, and maybe you're the only person that exists, and you've been programmed to think that everyone else exists, and Germany exists, and actually you've only been thinking this for about 15 seconds. There's no history. There's no world. Now, what's interesting is that you cannot empirically disprove that. You cannot empirically disprove that because it would obviously be circular reasoning. Circular reasoning means you take an argument. The typical structure of an argument is that you have premises and then a conclusion. So, for example, premise, all men are mortal. Women are not, as we know, but men are mortal. So all men are mortal. And the second premise is Socrates is a man. Conclusion, Socrates is mortal. So there, the conclusion, but take another type of argument where you say the material world, let's say this microphone really exists outside of myself. This microphone really exists outside of my mind. Therefore, a real world exists outside of my mind. The problem is that this microphone really exists outside of my mind only if there's a real material world outside of my mind. So in other words, what the argument really is saying is there's really a material world, therefore there's really a material world. It's just going around in circles. You're not really saying anything, you're just saying the same thing twice. The first time you say it, you pretend like it's an argument, and the second time you say it, you pretend it's a conclusion. But, in fact, scientists and almost everybody believes, not only believes, but almost everyone is convinced they know that there's a real world outside of our minds. How do we know that? Why is it that we accept there's a real world outside of our mind? Basically, to give you the short answer, because the quality of the experience. For example, example Plato gave. Let's say you have a dream. At night you dream and then you wake up. Why do you conclude? What makes you conclude when you wake up that the dream was a dream and this is really the world? In fact, it could be, theoretically, it could be that you were in the real world and then you, when you thought you woke up, you really fell asleep. But the reason that we believe that the dream was a dream and this is the world is because the quality of the experience. There's something about the experience that shows us that this is more real than that. And so in the same way, that is the way we do anything in the world. It's the way we know anything in the world. In the same way, when one experiences Krishna, one simply knows that the experience of Krishna is more real than anything else. It's the quality of the experience. And if you say that's not fair, then nothing is fair and science isn't fair. They have an expression in America, maybe you can translate it in German, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. The gander is the male goose.
What's good for the ganses is also good for the Gänserich.
Yeah. In other words, yes, I like that expression, even in German also. So that's the point. So the basis of believing in Krishna, philosophically, is the same as accepting the world. Therefore, to create this division that somehow accepting Krishna is completely different from the way we accept the material world shows that actually it's very good proof that in order to get a PhD in science, you do not have to take one course in philosophy. And certainly you don't have to take a course in epistemology. So, getting back to this point of the deities, if we ask, what is the context of matter? If we ask the simple question, the deity is made of matter. Here we have an object apparently made of wood, painted and so on, and we claim somehow that Krishna is present there. So you cannot investigate this claim unless you investigate the nature of matter. And you cannot investigate the nature of matter unless you know the context of matter, which is metaphysical. Because actually, and I'll show you why we, all of us in our real lives, accept that the metaphysical world is more important. Why do people give their lives to save their family? Why do people give their lives to defend their country? Why do people risk their lives to live in a free country? Which is unfortunately happening a lot now. People risking their lives and losing their lives because they're desperate to live in a free country. That means that human beings often place a metaphysical reality, namely justice, freedom, love for their family, they place a metaphysical reality above a physical reality. And that means that in people's real lives, we live in a bi-dimensional world, a physical and metaphysical world, and actually, ultimately, we accept that the metaphysical world is superior. So, by definition, a priori, it is not possible for any empirical science to fully explain the universe. It is logically impossible. Logically impossible means it's not that you go out and investigate, like, I heard there's a unicorn in Germany. And so you go out and you look everywhere in Germany trying to find the unicorn. It's not like that. In philosophy, when you say something is logically impossible, it means that it has nothing to do with empirical investigation. Simply based on what words mean, it's not possible. For example, if you say, I found a square circle. A square circle cannot exist simply because of what the words mean. It's not that you have to go out and look all over Germany to see if you can find a square circle or not. There cannot be a square circle because if someone says there is a square circle, they just don't know what the words mean. So in the same way, if someone says that an empirical science can fully explain the universe, they actually simply don't understand what they're talking about. Because the world that almost everyone accepts as real consists of a physical dimension and a metaphysical dimension. And therefore, only a science which includes both physical science and metaphysical science could possibly fully explain the universe. Therefore, that being the case, meine Freunde, since we cannot understand the universe without understanding both its physical and metaphysical dimensions, we also cannot ultimately understand matter unless we fully understand the universe. Therefore, we would have to understand something like a spiritual or metaphysical science also before we could understand matter. So now we'll finally get to the point. That was the introduction. I hope none of you believed you're going to eat tonight. It's not going to happen. I'm just kidding. So when we ask what is matter, the answer that Krishna gives in the Bhagavad Gita is that matter is the energy of God. Matter is the energy of God, and there's no obvious reason why that's not true. Someone may not believe it, but that's simply their belief. For example, in our society, in Germany, everywhere in the world, we have this common expression, blind faith. How do you say it in German?
Blindes Vertrauen. Blindes Vertrauen.
Blinder Glaube. Blinder Glaube. Blinder Glaube, blind faith. Now, it is obviously true that to believe something which is not true, or to disbelieve something that is true, is equally a mistake. For example, what if you have a disease, God forbid, or what if a person has a disease, there actually is a cure for the disease, but the person doesn't believe it and doesn't take it. So not believing something that is true could cost you your life. And not to speak of not believing in God if there actually is a God, as Pascal, the philosopher Pascal, pointed out. So therefore, if our culture was balanced, if our modern culture was fair, we would have two expressions, blind faith, blind doubt. Where is the expression blind doubt? Why doesn't modern culture have a common expression, blind doubt? The reason is obvious, because our culture is foolishly prejudiced against spiritual things. And therefore we have blind doubt, but not blind faith. We have blind faith, but not blind doubt. So, in the case of Krishna, if you look at the Middle East, the ancient Middle East, what scholars will say, and what I'm about to tell you, this is not some weird new idea I found on a website. This is just normal mainstream scholarship. If you look at the Old Testament, if you look at the Old Testament, the ancient Jewish world, the world that Jesus was born and lived in, what we find in the Old Testament is that there is wisdom, there is piety, there is poetry, there is history, but there is not systematic philosophy. Actually, systematic philosophy arose only in two places in the world. Every other part of the world borrowed systematic philosophy from those two places. Those two places are Europe and India. And what's interesting is those two places share a common language, Indo-European language. But in any case, that's another topic. But when you have systematic philosophy, such as metaphysics, ethics, political philosophy, epistemology, and so on, when you have systematic philosophy, you ask the question, what is matter? And that question was asked seriously in pagan Europe and in India. And once you ask it, now, when you don't ask that question, and you just assume that matter is somehow bad or profane or ungodly, then it becomes an offense to juxtapose, to bring together the most holy and the most profane. However, if we look more closely at matter, we find that actually it is also holy because it's also part of God. That's what Krishna explains in the Gita. Now, the environmental problem, that's what I promised you in the beginning, I would connect these two things. Actually, as most almost all historians understand this, that one of the root causes, one of the root causes of the environmental problem is cultural. Cultural. The idea that matter, the material world, is somehow ungodly and, you know, it's just the material world. Like, who cares about that? Because if you look at other societies, for example, if you look at animistic societies as such in the Amazon jungle, or if you look at India, in Vedic culture, you find there was this clear understanding, that matter itself is enchanted. Matter is filled with a divine presence. You find this in simple animistic societies, you find it in India. And actually, you found it in Europe, this idea as well. However, and for example, in the Old Testament. The Old Testament, as scholars understand, admits there are many gods in the universe. Therefore, the first commandment is, don't put other gods before this God. The first commandment doesn't say there are no gods, it just says, put them in the right order. Now, Paul, I don't want to get into this, I won't engage in Paul bashing here, but to make it very simple, Paul, as we find in his letters, actually rejected. He thought he was presenting the Old Testament, but he actually claims that only God exists, and besides that, the universe is void. There are only human beings and God, which is not the teaching of the Old Testament. And as you can see, it radically disenchants the world. It radically materializes the world, because if there are no divine beings, helpers, seraphim, if there's no one else in the universe, then it's just dead matter in the most vulgar sense. And that is the ultimate cause of the argument against worshiping the deity, and it's also one of the main causes of the environmental problem in the world. And so it's really cultural and philosophical. Philosophy is like psychology. For example, psychology, even if you don't study psychology, you have a psychology. Whether you study it or not, you have a psychology. And whether you study philosophy or not, you have a philosophy. And so just as it's better to be aware of your psychology, it's better to be aware of your philosophy. And therefore, this negative attitude toward matter and toward the world, toward nature. In fairness to Europe, even like in the Renaissance, people were rethinking their attitude toward matter. For example, in the Dark Ages, in the Middle Ages, it was said that there's only one book, which is the Bible. But then in the Renaissance, they began to say there are two books, the Bible and the Book of Nature. And this was actually logos, the philosophy of the logos that you find in the ancient Greco-Roman world. The logos is sort of this divine logic, this divine reason, which is in the mind of God. And therefore, when God creates the world, he invests in the world his own divine reason. He invests his divine reason in human being. That's why we can reason. That's why we can do science and philosophy. That's why we can be reasonable. And so we have the power with our own logos. We can investigate the world, and the logos within us, connects with the logos within nature, and by doing that, we connect with the mind of God. Which is actually a pretty nice idea. So it was for that reason, because this idea, which I think essentially is correct, was so popular among educated people in the ancient Greco-Roman world, that several generations after Jesus in West Turkey, a fairly educated person that wanted to try to attract educated people to the Jesus movement began his book by saying, "In the beginning was the Logos," which is translated, I don't know how it's translated in German. "In the beginning was the Word, in the beginning was the," whatever they say in different languages. But actually, it's "In the beginning was the Logos," which was sort of this direct appeal to that understanding. So there were different moments. If you study, for example, if you study the history of Catholicism in the Western world, there were many times when they had all kinds of images and deities. And then, maybe a century after the initial Protestant Reformation, there was something called, what was it? In Holland, they had what was called the iconoclastic fury, where Protestants went into all the Catholic churches in Holland and smashed everything that had a picture on it. This, of course, is very similar to Wahhabi Islam. And they smashed all the plate glass, the windows, you know, the painted windows, all the figures of different holy, they just smashed everything. It was called the iconoclastic fury. So if you study Western culture, if you study even the history of Western culture, even if you study the history in the Old Testament, interestingly, if you just look at the numbers and study the history, it seems that for most of the time that the first temple existed in Jerusalem, the temple conceived by David and built by Solomon, it seems that for most of the time the temple was there, there were deities in it, actually. Because you have an original thing where, of course, it wasn't, but then there's generation after generation of kings, these genealogies. After many generations, one king realizes, oh my God, we've deviated, you know, we've done this. And then he wipes all the deities out of the temple in Jerusalem, but then the next king after him puts them back in. So it's very interesting. You know, they say that the winners write the history. And so we even know that ancient Israel was a very complex, intellectually complex place. For example, Solomon. the wise King Solomon actually had, I guess what Jewish people would say, a shiksa wife, a non-Jewish wife. He had various wives, and so one of them had been a pagan, and so he built for her on the Temple Mount, he actually built for her a little shrine where she could worship her deities. So what I'm saying is, if you look at the history of the world, it's complex. There were different things going on. There were different ideas. And I think it's not, I would argue, that it's not entirely for nothing that those parts of the world that were most advanced in philosophy tended to have deities. Because they were able to think about matter in creative, philosophical ways. But in any case, here we are in our pagan glory. So, any questions on these points? Yes.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
You described or you explained that with our intelligence, with reason, with logic, we can prove that science or
empirical science.
Empirical science is actually a belief system.
I'm saying that it cannot give a complete description of the universe.
Yeah, but because their argument is usually we believe and they don't believe.
But they do believe.
Yeah. So in my question, which I always think, how can we argue about a metaphysical world? Because their logic and reason, intelligence is actually.
I'll give you an example.
You need revelation.
I'll give you an example of the metaphysical world. Okay, democracy. That's an example of the metaphysical world. If you think about it, in Germany and in all the you could say modern developed countries. For example, a justice system. This was actually a result, among other things, of the French Revolution. They had a movement which Napoleon actually took to Germany and all over Europe, which was called constitutionalism, which was against the idea of absolute monarchy, that the king is above the law. Constitutionalism says that even the king can commit a crime and can be convicted of a crime. So this idea of constitutionalism, which is, of course, related to the idea of equality, which is a metaphysical idea. What people have to do is this. If you discover, as any rational human being should discover very easily, that you live in a bi-dimensional universe, then if you have any interest in being a rational human being and not a fanatic, either a religious fanatic or an unreligious fanatic, if you are interested in actually understanding the world you live in, then you need to look for a metaphysical science. Now, whether you're going to find it or not, which one you're going to choose, will it be strawberry or chocolate or vanilla? The point is that if you are not looking for a metaphysical science, you are not, in a serious sense of the word, a rational human being. So if you're okay with that, go watch the soccer game and have a lot of beer. And that's your absolute truth. Yes?
I got a question on your ideas how to spread Krishna consciousness in the Western countries.
Yes.
Countries, because it is usual that people in ISKCON temples, also in the West, where devotees and things like that, and I think you got another more modern ideas how to spread this consciousness. I would be very interested in hearing your ideas.
I paid him to ask that question.
It seems that way, yeah.
Thank you. The check is in the mail. So, okay, I believe there's... I believe there is a somewhat common philosophical mistake among some devotees, which leads to a problem in terms of how to present ourselves. And that is, first of all, I'll tell you a philosophical point which we actually accept, and then a very common misinterpretation of it, which leads to problems and makes it very difficult for us to try to develop our mission. The true fact, according to us, is that when you surrender to Krishna, in other words, when you take up serious devotional service according to the principles Prabhupada gave us, then you become, even in this life, spiritually liberated. Obviously, you still have a material body. Your body still needs to take a bath every day and so on. But the idea is that liberated in the sense that you are free from your past karma, that you are no longer forced to take birth again in this world. So, I believe that people have some devotees, I won't say many, but some devotees, have interpreted this to mean that if you are a serious practicing Vaishnava, you are above the laws of nature, which is not the case. The example I always give, if a karmi, as we put it, we have all these very affectionate terms, if a karmi, the K word, if a karmi, a jnani, a yogi, and a devotee all fall off the same building, they all fall at exactly the same speed, according to the laws of physics.
The yogi is different. You can.
not today's yogis. So, to give an example of how this misunderstanding, thinking you're free from karma, means you're beyond the laws of nature, which are Krishna's laws, an example of how this understanding led to disastrous consequences. In the early days of the movement, and unfortunately even today in some places, devotees believe that because I am eating prasadam, food offered to Krishna, spiritual food, I don't have to worry about nutrition. This has led to quite a number of premature leavings of body. You know, Prabhupada disciples, I think. I mean, it seems like Prabhupada disciples as a group are not the healthiest people in the world. I mean, I fortunately had a very good mother, and so I, you know, always trying to keep healthy, but... But anyway, so that's an example. There's another example which is even more tragic. And that is, in the early days of the movement, many devotees thought that because, you know, I have children, but because I'm going out and selling Prabhupada's books, or because I'm going out and preaching, therefore I don't have to spend a lot of time with my children. And the result was catastrophic. So, in the same way, if we ask the simple question, under what historical conditions does a new spiritual or religious movement, and we may not be new in one sense, but in Germany it's still new, under what historical conditions does a new spiritual movement succeed and become important, and under what historical conditions does it fail? Now, ironically, very few people among devotees, and it doesn't matter, ISKCON, Gaudiya Math, this, that, whatever, just very few devotees ever ask this question. In fact, I think it's fair to say most devotees don't even know it is a question, or it's even a question that should be asked. Prabhupada says in the Bhagavatam that we should engage all human sciences in Krishna's service. Because after all, human, real science, not saying life comes from matter, not pseudoscience, but real science, which is simply the systematic investigation of the laws of God. So, if we study history, if we study social science, and ask under what conditions is it possible, not necessary, but possible, for a new religious or spiritual movement to grow and succeed, under what conditions will it necessarily fail? We find that if you are a little spiritual movement, and we are eine kleine spiritual movement, not music, if a new movement like that places itself outside society, it must fail. Especially in our case. And actually, social scientists give us as an example of what to do wrong. Seriously, social scientists who are not demons, they're just social scientists. And they give us as an example of what to do wrong. If you actually could have been successful but didn't make it. You know, and this is, they give us as an example. So, especially in our case, because culture is like water. I've made this point. It flows down, not up. In the world today, social scientists talk about prestige cultures. For example, in the ancient world, including Israel, Greek was the prestige language. It was the English of its time. Sorry about that, about the English. So therefore, the New Testament was not written in the language that Jesus actually spoke. Jesus didn't teach in Greek, he taught in Aramaic. The New Testament was written in Greek. Why? Because that was the prestige language, and also because it took a generation or two to get people to actually write. So, according to the New Testament. So anyway, in the world today, for example, Germany. In the world today, I just read an article a few months ago that Germany was voted the leading national brand in the world. They do these studies, like, because countries have images. So they do this study, like, which countries have the most popular images. And actually, Germany won. The last time they studied it, it had the most popular, the most positive national brand, like the country that the people most admired in the world. India, of course, was far, far down on the list. So the point I'm making is that therefore, culture is not going to flow against the, so to speak, the cultural laws of gravity. Culture is not going to flow up from India, which is near the bottom of national images, to Germany, which is at the top. That just doesn't happen. Yes.
Well, but Hermann Hesse, who wrote the book Steppenwolf, which is popular in the U.S., also wrote a book. It's called Siddhartha.
I know Siddhartha.
And yes. Gave a certain popularity to Indian culture in Germany. So it's always an exchange between countries and between epochs.
It's not merely an exchange. I mean, it is an exchange, but it's like a trade. It's like, you know, foreign trade. You know, one country may import a million things from Germany, and then they send, you know, whistles or something. So there's no trade balance there. For example, when I go around Germany, I see very few people in Germany sitting on the banks of rivers meditating. I see very few Germans dressed like Indians. I see. So what Hermann Hesse did, actually I had a really good course in 20th century German literature at Berkeley. Professor was a German, young German guy. He was really good. And he was talking about Siddhartha. We studied it. And Siddhartha actually had zero influence on Germany in terms of ethnic things. It didn't cause Germans to dress like Indians or eat like Indians. It was the idea. It was philosophy. What actually attracted the Germans was philosophy. And so, therefore, if you have real philosophy or real science, any kind of science, yes, Germans and everybody else will be interested. Because science, it just goes everywhere. For example, if someone invents a cure for cancer, let's say, no one in the world cares that much where it came from. They may appreciate it came from this country, you know, China, Japan, America, Germany, England, whatever. But science is science. But ethnicity, ethnic things, are not science. And therefore, what we need to do, I believe, if we are to have any hope whatsoever of succeeding in Germany, is to focus on spiritual science and spiritual philosophy and not try to culturally colonize Germany. Because I think I can say very safely that Germany is not going to be culturally colonized by India. It's really not going to happen. And if someone thinks it is going to happen, I suggest, you know, I would just say that Germany has excellent mental health facilities, and you know, talk to someone about your belief. If you think that Germany is going to be culturally colonized in terms of external culture, by an external culture, which is not even Vedic. Actually, if you look at the external culture of India, including food, architecture, music, dress, all kinds of things, much of it is just half comes from Muslims, which doesn't mean it's bad. It's just, it's ridiculous to say it's Vedic. And you see this all the time. For example, there was just a big Guru Kuli wedding. You know, Guru Kuli means devotees born in the movement. In New Vrindavan, and they wanted to really be Vedic, all the young men who were with the groom, they all dressed up like Muslim princes. They thought they were being Vedic, but in fact, they were all dressing like Muslim princes. Or, for example, you should only offer Krishna the special foods he likes, even if half of those food preparations actually come from Turkey. Because, again, it's, you know, the Muslim leaders, there were actually two historical periods in Muslim domination, especially of northern India and at times other parts of India. There was first what is called the Delhi Sultanate, which came from Central Asian invasions. And that began, you know, sort of late, the actual rule maybe late in the 11th century, you know, 1000 and something. And then that Delhi Sultanate, they were defeated by the Mughals, who were actually Mongols, were called Mughals, and they came and they dominated India for several centuries until the British, who, you know, in the British way, ended up in charge. So, the point here is that, for example, look at Bosnia, where Suleiman the Magnificent and other Ottoman rulers conquered what became Yugoslavia. And a lot of what went on and still goes on in the Balkan states is a result of that Ottoman invasion of Southeast Europe. And they were ruled there for about, you know, 300-400 years. Imagine what it means for a different culture, in this case Muslim culture, to rule India for, it would be about 700 years. That's a very long time. 600 to 700 years. That's an extremely long time that they actually ruled India. And they, of course, in those days, you didn't just make a CD and put it out, you know, hope people download it. For example, for all those maybe 600 years, 500 to 600 years, for all that time, it's a very long time, just like in Europe, during the same time, music was done only with the patronage of the church or the nobles. You know, that changed. If you look at the transition from Baroque music into early classical music, you see that patronage changed, and therefore, you know, you could actually, and that's why, for example, the lute was replaced by the guitar, and why the harpsichord was replaced by the piano, because they were louder and you started getting a larger audience. It wasn't just a few church elders or some nobles in a very opulent room. It was actually the public. So therefore, they needed louder instruments. But in any case, the point I'm making is that in India, just like everywhere, just like in Europe, to make music, to live as a musician, you needed patronage, royal patronage, from the Muslim government. And the Muslim government favored Muslims. So that Muslims, even today in India, most of the classical musicians in India today are Muslims. And therefore, what we call Vedic music is basically music which for the last, you know, which for centuries and centuries and centuries was under the control of Muslim culture. Now, you could say, well, maybe the Muslims were just preserving earlier music that goes, that's actually Vedic music. We don't know that. Why don't we know that? Because in Indian classical music, unlike Western classical music, they didn't write things down. You know, early on in Western classical, Western, in general, Western culture was very much focused on literate culture in the sense of writing things down. Like if you look at the old Anglo-Saxon English records, it's, oh my God, like why did they keep so many records? But they did. You know, everything, every time a stone rolled down a hill, someone wrote it down. Oops, stone rolled down there. Whereas, if you look at Indian history, they could go literally 1,000 or 2,000 years and not write one history book. Empires rose and fell, and no one even wrote a book about it. I mean, it's astonishing, but true. And if you look at music, Indian music, they place much higher value than in the West on improvisation. Improvisation. It was a different concept. And so, whereas in Western music, say the Baroque period, which was roughly, I mean very roughly, musical periods don't just start and stop, you know, like, okay, hey everybody, it's 1600, let's do Baroque music. No. But roughly it started in 1600, and it ended around 1750. Actually, that's really nasty, because Bach died in 1750, but Handel lived for 8 more years. So it's actually kind of silly to say it ended in 1750. Anyway, those are roughly the days for Baroque music. They did have improvisation. They did have improvisation, but it was much more limited. You had a very clearly written score. You know, you had the music written, and then you were given a little freedom to invent, you know, a little what they call ornamentation, you know, ornaments, trills, and this thing, and that thing, and the other thing. But basically, the music was written. In India, much more improvisational, and they didn't write it down. And so therefore, what did music sound like when Krishna was here 5,000 years ago? As the Beach Boys said, God only knows. So, if I just finish this point and then... So, my point here is that whether it's in terms of Muslim shirt, the Arabic word for shirt being kurta, whether it's foods, you know, whether it's music, whether it's architecture, there is a huge amount of Muslim influence, which doesn't mean it's bad, it just means it's not eternal Vedic culture. And so at this point, trying to impose upon Germany or trying to convince the German people that if you want to have a strong relationship with God, you need to dress like an Indian and eat like an Indian and make Indian music, otherwise, you know, God won't accept you. Does that sound rational to anybody in this room? So, the idea of Krishna West is, give people a break. I mean, that's the idea. Give the Germans a break. I mean, leave them alone. And just, you know, just give them a spiritual science. Give them this wisdom and just let them be happy Krishna conscious Germans. That's the basic idea. I'm sorry, this lady made me think back. Yes.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna. Guten Abend.
Hare Krishna. I want to say that the closest from the original closest from Hare Krishna devotees are so powerful, so spiritual, so religious, so holy, and when there's a temple where everybody with this closest. It, also, then the atmosphere is so holy and purifying. I find this, and I'm so happy when I see this. And when I saw them the first time, I laughed so much. The closest, and I don't like this, this German culture. I mean, I don't know, I cannot speak.
No, I get the message,
yes,
and I...
I'm so sad when they don't have this concept.
I appreciate your honesty. I would only say that you have every right in the world to do what makes you happy in Krishna consciousness. But the point is, other people do also. We don't want fashion tyranny. In other words, there are many people in the world, believe me, they write me letters. There are many people in the world who feel more Krishna conscious, more natural, more themselves when they don't wear Indian clothes. And if you like it, so it's about freedom, Freiheit. It's about me not trying to force you to wear clothes that I like and you not trying to force me to wear clothes that you like. And, you know, people are different. And so, Krishna West, that's the name of our very dangerous deviation. But the idea of Krishna West is not to try to force you to do something you don't want to do. It's simply to say that everyone has a right to be themselves. Oscar Wilde, the English writer, once said, just be yourself because everybody else is already taken. And so, I know for myself, I don't think if I was wearing, you know, an Indian dhoti, which by the way comes from the wrong Krishna mission, that's where Bhakti Sanatana got it, or a kurta, the dhoti, sannyas dhoti, it comes from the wrong Krishna mission. Bhakti Sanatana borrowed it from them. I really don't think that I would love Krishna more. I don't think I'd be happier. And here's another important point. Many devotees have this really bad habit of comparing the greatest things in India with the worst things in the West. So India always wins. Like, you know, compare a nice chaste sari with some, you know, with some woman, you know, doing things maybe she shouldn't do, exposing herself. And so why not compare? I mean, I'm traveling around Europe now for several months, and frankly, this is not like a totally oversexed, out-of-control region of the world. And it is summer. I mean, if people are just going to really go nasty, now's the time. And what I found traveling all over France and Spain and Italy and now Germany is that there's just nice, decent human beings. And so this caricature, this wild exaggeration, yes, in Europe and in America and in India, there are people who are extremely degraded. For example, a woman is much safer in Germany than she is in India. It's much less likely she'll be raped. I think that's significant. I find that significant. And I also find having a culture where women are not raped all the time, Vedic. I call that Vedic. I mean, I see many ways in which Germany is more Vedic than India. And I see, of course, very important ways in which India is more Krishna conscious. The fact that in Germany people actually keep public spaces clean. The fact that, you know, there are social services. There are actually social services, unlike other parts of the world. The fact that there's a certain amount of security, personal security. All those things, if you read, you know, Prabhupada's explanations of the duties of a government in Vedic culture, we'll find that in some, to me, very significant human ways, Germany is much more Vedic than India. Much more. They're not even close. I will also find, when I study Indian history, for example, I cannot find any time in Indian history when a sari or a dhoti were considered in India by Indians to be Vaishnava dress. But again, it's because of your personal psychology and your background and just who you are, if that's what works for you, if it makes you happy and it makes you Krishna conscious, then do it. But we can't force other people to do it who don't want to do it. And we also cannot put out a message to the world, or in Germany, that sure, you can join the Hare Krishna movement, you don't have to do all these Indian things, of course you'll be a second-class citizen for the rest of your life, but don't worry about that. After all, the goal is to become humble. So, yes, I respect completely your freedom to live in a way that makes you Krishna conscious. And I'm sure you respect the freedom of other people to do the same. Yes, you want to ask a question, then Nitya Siddha. Eternamente liberado.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, I go along with a lot of the issues you made. But so, what is your advice? What is the core message for the ISKCON or for the Krishna movement in the Western? What is the core, which should be the elements? Because you say maybe not all of the scriptures of the 50 books of Prabhupada are maybe necessary. So what is the core? And what is the branding? And how should we act? And is there a possibility to keep that under the roof of ISKCON in a kind of unity lived by diversity?
Yes. First of all, I am not at all thinking of deleting some of Prabhupada's books. I mean, it would be absurd for me to think that I could do that. Prabhupada's my spiritual master. It's not my duty to delete his books. Secondly, one part of Krishna West, it's my sinister cult, one part of it is to actually encourage people like German devotees to think. You know, it's interesting because Prabhupada declared often when he came to the West that he wanted to recreate a Brahmin class, a thinking class, because modern society was a headless body. And of course, ISKCON is a disembodied head. You know, ISKCON is a head without a body, and society is a body without a head. So, but the point is that even though Prabhupada said he wanted a movement where people think, where they're creative, within reasonable boundaries. I mean, for example, in Germany, you're free within boundaries. Obviously, if you cross certain boundaries, you're a criminal. And you should be. I mean, that's what you really are. But within reasonable boundaries, you're free. That's the kind of movement Prabhupada envisioned. And so, for example, take culture. How should you dress? What I'm proposing is not cultural anarchy. Like, okay, you come in front of the deities wearing some kind of, I don't know, you know, zebra skin male bikini or something. No, that's not the idea. Because actually, sorry for that somewhat graphic image.
What has been seen cannot be unseen.
Good now. So, actually, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna actually gives us a cultural criterion. He doesn't say, offer me Indian things. That's not what Krishna says. What Krishna does say in the Bhagavad Gita, or encourage us to do, is to act in the mode of goodness. So, if I, for example, come to a temple, I should dress myself in a way that's virtuous. That means chaste, decent, clean. See, this idea that Indian ethnic traditions are the only barrier that separate us from anarchy and chaos and utter degradation, and that if we don't all embrace Indian culture, nothing will save us from, you know, the abyss of barbarity, is it's a way over dramatic. The point is, Krishna gives us a standard. How should you dress? in the mode of goodness. Clean, decent, chaste, mode of goodness. Food, offer Krishna food that's in the mode of goodness, which of course eliminates a somewhat high percentage of Mahaprasadam in ISKCON around the world. You know, if you just lived on Mahaprasadam, you probably wouldn't live very long. And actually, Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that food in the mode of goodness is healthy. So the idea that Krishna wants food in the lower modes of nature, I'm not quite convinced of. Because in the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna almost a few dozen times, maybe like over 20, 22, 23 times, Krishna compares things in the three modes of nature to give us the idea so we can do it by ourselves, you know, with everything. And food in the mode of passion is spicy and hot. Sound familiar? Do you know of any spiritual movements that have spicy hot food? So, and food in the mode of goodness, I mean, I once went to a program with some people from the, you know, Indian cooking, and I gave a lecture and the food was so spicy, so hot, I couldn't eat it. I said, just bring me some fruit. So they brought me a fruit salad with chili pepper in it. I swear to Govinda. So, so offer food to Krishna. Prabhupada once said to me, Prabhupada said, eat what you like and it will be good for you. So, offer, so mode of goodness. It's not cultural anarchy. In fact, what I've seen is that we have placed above philosophy and above objectivity simply cultural chauvinism. I'll give you an example. I saw on YouTube a Rathiatra in the Western world, somewhere in the Western world, and after the Rathiatra parade, they had, you know, the festival and the stage program, and they had this Bollywood group come on. And this Bollywood group did sort of like a song and dance, and the only way I can describe it is erotic. It was like explicitly and heavily erotic in terms of, anyway. No one noticed, and no one minded. In other words, it obviously was inappropriate at a Rathiatra festival. It was very erotic. However, that doesn't matter. There was a higher principle involved. It was Indian. So if you do something Western, it's bad even if it's good. And if it's Indian, it's good even if it's bad. I saw another Rathiatra. You see, I didn't tell you about the NSA and my connection. Anyway, I investigated ISKCON for the NSA. So I looked on YouTube. Just kidding. Actually, I have no idea what Angela Merkel says on her phone. I actually have no idea. So there was another Rathiatra. There was another Rathiatra in, this was actually in an Eastern European country. And they had this couple, man or woman, young man, young woman, who were Western, they were from that country. And they put on sort of like this yoga dance. They played music and they just kind of like did this dance in which they did different yoga postures. This was on the stage at a Rathiatra. The girl was wearing clothes that were so tight that it was an excellent lesson in female anatomy, if you wanted one. But this was at the Rathiatra, on the stage, where you get this very vivid anatomy lesson, you know, and I think the girl was sincere. I think she was just trying to serve Krishna. But the point is, if it's Indian, in this case yoga, it's good, even if it's bad. And if it's Western, it's bad, even if it's good. That is called chauvinism. That's not spiritual science. That's called chauvinism. And so, in the mode of goodness, what does it look like? I think it looks like following Prabhupada's program, practicing spiritual life, following Prabhupada's teachings, trying to share them with others. In other words, Prabhupada's program. Prabhupada's teachings, Prabhupada's spiritual program, being in Prabhupada's ISKCON, that was another question you raised, but just doing it in a way that allows people to add Krishna to their lives without becoming second or third class members of ISKCON. There are hundreds and thousands of stories of sincere devotees being intimidated, bullied, harassed, and rejected because they would not adopt Indian culture. Not Krishna. They accepted Krishna. They accepted Prabhupada. They accepted ISKCON. They accepted everything. They just didn't want to be Indian, and therefore they were bullied and harassed. There are too many stories like that. You know, we have to open our eyes. If I went to Prabhupada, and I told him, Prabhupada, there are some problems. Your movement is not like it used to be in the sense that it's no longer relevant. It's no longer really growing the way it used to be. If I said that to Prabhupada, I know exactly what he would say to me. He would say, fix it. He would say, fix it. So I'm working with an ISKCON. I'm Prabhupada's disciple. I'm unfortunately, as I always say, the last active preacher in ISKCON who was trained by Prabhupada as a Western GBC. So, and somehow by Prabhupada's mercy, we had great results. So I know what Prabhupada wanted because he kept telling me. And so I'm trying to understand history. I'm trying to understand social science. I'm trying to understand ISKCON history, Vaishnav history. In fact, we can see that whenever Vaishnavism succeeded in India, say, or even other places like Indonesia, whenever Vaishnavism succeeded, the Vaishnavas adapted to the culture they were in. They did not sacrifice or compromise their philosophy or their spiritual practices or their institution, but they did give people the opportunity to add Krishna to their life. And if we do that in Germany, really do it, not just say it. Because as we know, social science shows that when people put out a message, whether it's political candidates in a debate or someone else preaching, you know, what you say is a small part of the impression people have. Most of the impression people take is what they really see, like who are you, and what kind of person are you, and just what they call body language and what your life is like. And so we may say to people, oh yes, you can just add Krishna to your life. But I believe that in general, the Hare Krishna movement is shouting, as we say in English, shouting from the rooftops. You have to be Indian if you want to be a serious bhakti yogi. You have to be Indian. Because that's spiritual. And so, wrong message, in my view. The message is, you need spiritual science in your life, not you need to be Indian. As far as having a festival of India, I believe we should seriously rethink this. It's not about India, it's about spiritual science. And Germany, I mean, Germans practically, you know, they were one of the people who invented science. You know, what is his name? Paracelsus? I mean, Germans are famous all over the world. They've always been famous as scientists, as scholars, as philosophers. I mean, it's one of the most respected countries in history in terms of science and philosophy. And I trust the German people that if they're presented with a real spiritual science, I believe they'll accept it. If we actually present that with no all kinds of other conditions. Like, okay, you can have a spiritual science if you dress like this, if you do that, then you can have a... No, why? Why may people jump through hoops? We're supposed to be making things easier for people, not more difficult. I mean, it's hard enough to chant Hare Krishna. I mean, devotees know that. You know, chanting 16 rounds. It's hard enough to practice bhakti yoga. Why make it harder? Why make it harder? And is there any evidence whatsoever, for example, that when Lord Chaitanya personally took his Harinam party out in Navadvip, is there any evidence that Lord Chaitanya and his followers were dressed differently than everyone else? No, there's no evidence. No one asked Lord Chaitanya or his followers, hey, why are you dressed like that? So as far as the details, they say, you know, the devil's in the details. So as far as the details, I actually trust, I really trust the intelligence of the German devotees. I think that despite our, you know, the struggle here in Germany, that Krishna has very kindly sent some very intelligent, sincere Vaishnavas to take birth in this country, or to migrate. And my experience in being here in Germany a few days is there's more than enough intelligence here, sincerity, devotion, creativity to figure this out. And I don't want to, frankly, in some ways, repeat some of the mistakes of the past. And that is sort of creating an ISKCON culture where no one's supposed to think, you know, the leader will think for you. That's the problem, not the solution. And, of course, I mean, there's some things a leader has to come and say certain things like, this is Prabhupada teaches, we need theological discipline. We can't have a movement with no quality control, that anyone can go to an ISKCON temple and preach any philosophy, or anyone can ignore our principles. No. When it comes to philosophy, and when it comes to our principles, no one practices bhakti yoga perfectly. So if you don't practice bhakti yoga perfectly, you're basically like everybody else. And the real point of bhakti yoga is do your best. If you do your best and I do my best, we're doing the same thing. Someone may have more experience, someone may be in a past life, whatever. But whatever stage you're at, if you're doing your best, you are as dear to Krishna as anyone else that's doing their best, whatever it looks like. And so, in terms of our spiritual practice, and in terms of our philosophy, we have to have discipline. But in terms of the superficial part, the details, how you present things, the package, there's more than enough intelligence and creativity in the Vaishnava community here to figure that out. And obviously, practically everyone in this room knows a lot more about Germany than I do, despite my studies and my German language course at UCLA. So, yeah, that's my request to you, as Prabhupada would say. I mean, what I'm really asking you to do is use your intelligence within Prabhupada's standards, within Prabhupada's principles. You figure it out. It's your country. You're supposed to figure it out. And find a way to present real Krishna consciousness within Prabhupada's standards in a way the Germans can easily and happily accept it and be happy. So as, you know, Sarvang Janaha, which in Sanskrit means that's all, folks. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.